of course, one of the big stars on The X-Files, and he's making a documentary called The Truth Is Out There.
One of the things that UFO research has done to me is instill in me a healthy disrespect for the things that government says.
They are poisoning our people. There is a population control agenda. There really are people who want to kill off the majority of the people in the world.
If we don't allow these corrupt banks to fail, then the nation will fail, and there will be no recovery.
Don't stand on the sides of the river and comment on how corrupt and dark and evil everything is. We all know that.
I don't need to have you understand or agree with me or believe. It doesn't matter to me. I know what I know.
The name of our film is?
The truth is out there.
But it really isn't.
But isn't there a universal truth that science is going for?
Perhaps the universal truth is what makes us subject.
Okay, you just blew my mind.
From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood.
Hollywood Hour.
I'm leaving.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
As a two-parter that this show is.
This really is. It's a two-part installment.
It's so intense.
We began last week by giving a critical analysis, subtextual reading of X-Files, I Want to Believe, the second X-Files movie.
And you say we have gone so deep into this movie. It is far deeper than I ever gave this movie credit for, frankly.
But this is the culture in which we live. We give this crack analysis. Something's good, bad, we like it, we don't like it, and rarely do we bother to actually explore it.
Sit down and explore it. Yeah, absolutely. And here we are now.
And whether one likes the movie, doesn't like the movie, enjoyed it, didn't enjoy it, thought it was good, bad, thought it was X-Files, not X-Files, whatever they thought, this film is rich for exploration.
Absolutely, because Chris Carter, Frank Spotnitz are storytellers that work on many levels, and all these levels are showing up here in... huge.
So if you're not an X-Files fan, first of all, if you haven't listened to last week's show,
go listen.
You better listen to it because we did the first half of the movie, the analysis, and we'll keep resetting certain themes. But this is not. We're not talking about plot.
No.
We're not analyzing story.
No.
And we're analyzing how this film lives metaphorically, culturally, subversively, mythologically, and in our collective dreams.
Subconscious in the dream world.
And so if you're not a fan of The X-Files or of this kind of analysis of art, we'll talk to you next week.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, so many movies now are like, oh, this was poorly directed, or this wasn't right, or, you know, I like the book better. But nobody can actually articulate why or what potentially was resonating with them or was not resonating
yes,
with them.
Yes, I mean, I experienced this, by the way, when we had our test screening several months ago of The Lady Killers. Uh-huh. And, you know, people would come up to you, and there'd be certain, you know, suggestions or criticisms that people would have that would be echoed by other people.
Right.
And you're always on the lookout for those.
Right.
But there was this wonderful, almost like receiving line of people saying, this could be shortened. Going on to another thing, this could be shortened. And then another thing. And that was like, with The Truth Is Out There, we experienced that where no two people could agree on what it was that was being shortened.
Right.
Some people saying, oh my goodness, that scene was so long. And I would think, really? And I would go home and I would time it, and it would be 18 seconds long.
Right, right.
And what it was revealing of their own material.
Yes.
It was very long to them.
To them.
Because it poked at something.
Right.
So if we don't, as a culture, drop beneath the I like it or I dislike it, we ignore one of the major purposes of storytelling and entertainment and art and culture and the humanities, which is that the humanities make us more humane. Mm-hmm. And why do they make us more humane? By inspiring us to look at things about ourselves.
Right.
Not about what we like or dislike, but about what affects us.
And this is why you should go into the humanities in college.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, you know, you can go in your business majors, you can go in your MBAs, you can go make a ton of money, but at the end of it, you won't know anything more about what makes you you. And going into the humanities, going in your philosophies and your film studies and all of these arts may negate some sort of billion-dollar mansion that you might get, but at the same time, you will be more connected to yourself.
And this was the great appeal of movies, right? Going back to the silent era, it was an entertainment form that was affordable by the masses, the same way theater was affordable to the masses during Shakespeare's time.
Right.
Shakespeare was not elitist culture. Shakespeare was for the masses.
There was the halfpenny pit, and then the upper balconies were people who could pay 4 to 5 pennies.
Can you imagine? You would stand in the pit, wouldn't you?
You would stand in the pit.
And
you would
watch multiple hours worth of entertainment.
Theater, and you would actually heckle and stuff like that to the actors that would respond to you.
But so, from the early days of cinema, people from all walks would go in and to see these collective dreams projected, and we'd be aware of this almost, for lack of a better word, sacred aspect to it, because what was being reflected back to us was ourselves.
Yeah.
And we were aware of it. We would see ourselves in it. We would find ourselves in it. And somewhere along the lines, probably to a degree because of the advent of technology and the more immediate nature of watching things and the lack of the sacred aspect of it.
Right. Television to iPhones to iPads to Vine.
We now are at the time where we can shut off whatever we can watch whatever we want whenever we want to, and we can immediately shut it off if it's not working for us.
And we can also record ourselves and upload it and share it even though no one else is looking at it. It's like it's a big echo chamber.
But if we can shut it off because it's quote unquote not working for us, then we get to ignore anything in the human experience that quote unquote doesn't work for us, instead of asking the questions, why is it affecting me this way? And this leads
the X-Files
to where we left off last week, where you were suddenly realizing that some of the criticisms that you had that other people had, though on one level, totally understandable criticisms, but that if you simply ask yourself, well, why would they do this?
Then that
leads into a different conversation.
And almost is the point.
That can be the point.
Yes. And now suddenly, Chris Carter and Frank are back to where they were.
Well,
brilliant.
It begs two conversations, only one of which we're having here, which is about the deeper meanings and resonances of X-Files, I Want to Believe, which will hopefully inspire people to do this same kind of approach and analysis to works that they love or to works that disturb them.
Right, that
because
they hate
I guarantee
it.
You, if you hated it, you want to look at it because it has a lot to say about you.
Right, exactly.
That doesn't make it good.
No, what it does
mean is that it's an enriching experience.
Absolutely. I'm going to go back to Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz in Night and Day because I so hated that.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. And I think that probably there's something resonating there.
I don't know.
I'm just saying.
That might have just been bad. but the other conversation that, of course, we had is that when you've got a franchise like The X-Files, where it becomes so popular, in between shows, we talked about this a little bit, that one of the reasons it's so difficult for a television series to move the needle of cultural discussion the way a film can, which seems counterintuitive because
you would think
even
TV,
the most failed television shows, boy, if a movie could have the audience size of a canceled TV show, that movie would be a hit.
Right.
In most cases.
Absolutely. But the way we consume television is different than the way we consume movies.
And the number of people that it requires to continue requires such an audience size.
It's true.
That you must appeal to that it almost always diminishes the depth to which that work will resonate with people.
Yeah.
And it's why when you do have shows that really do resonate so deeply that they move that needle of conversation, there's always some story involving failure overcome that is involved in these shows. Think of Star Trek. Star Trek was a failure. It needed to be saved by a letter writing campaign. It needed to be saved a second time. It then got canceled, and it really only became truly popular after it was off the air in reruns.
Yeah, yeah. And that's when it really connected.
And that's when it started to deeply affect cultural conversation. The X-Files was not a hit.
No.
In this country.
That's true. Especially. And it took till the New Yorker article in the second season. It was one article, and they said, you got to watch this show because it is hitting on something that is bigger than the show itself.
Bigger than the show itself.
And so that was the first.
And that, along with some awards and notoriety, its success in the UK, Golden Globes, these things allowed it to survive through its time of a small audience and grow. But what happens, inevitably, certainly in both the case of The X-Files and of Star Trek, is it ends up becoming a slave to its own popularity.
Right.
And a mythology that grows organically now becomes the tail that wags the dog.
I know.
And the created, the manufactured mythology now weighs down, suppresses, strangles, and extinguishes the possibility for the authentic mythological expression of our shared collective unconscious.
Well, I don't know. I would stop at extinguished. I would say that because the weight of all of this knowledge that they take in, you read your reviews, you know what's going on culturally, yet you try to go back to that original spark that made you write that thing.
Fair enough, which I think we've now already established clearly Chris Carter and Frank Spotnitz did.
Yeah.
They went back. They delved deep into the archetypal, mythological underpinnings of the dreamscape in which these stories originate and from which they evolved. However, when they bring them up to the surface, they now find that they really can't survive the assault of shared cultural expectation.
Right.
An expectation largely based on the created mythological baggage of these characters and their journey.
And this is the problem with so many projects out there. I mean, you think of Marvel, you think of
you think of the J.J. Abrams Star Trek. Congratulations, you made money off of it. But by the time of the second quote-unquote Star Trek movie, you realize there is not a spark of what was Star Trek alive in this thing.
Absolutely. And as you pointed out in the Star Wars trailer about sentimentality, where Harrison Ford and a Chewbacca come up and go, we're home, and that like thing is like, it is
that is
desperate.
Giving the people what they want.
Totally.
But there is not a part of you that can honestly believe that that line would exist anywhere in the Star Wars universe.
Right. So here's the thing. There's examples all over the internet of all these trailers of upcoming projects where they are negating the very essence of why they do these projects.
Why they were created in the first place.
And listen, J.J. Abrams is what? Second, third generation now? Director of television? Like his dad was, and his,
I don't know.
And his grandfather, like if you look up IMDb and go J.J. Abrams and look him back, he is from a long line of Hollywood workers, and he is doing exactly what all Hollywood writers and scriptwriters do, is deliver this stuff. So,
and why do we bring that up? Because if there is an X-Files 3, if the reboot either survives enough to warrant an X-Files 3, it will be directed by J.J. Abrams.
Ah! But the 6 episodes on Netflix? Wow.
Okay, so where we left off, there were these interesting back-to-back scenes of experimental medical procedures.
Yes.
And it's approaching the middle of the movie.
Right.
And it's fascinating that,
An hour.
Scully... let's talk about Scully Googling these therapies, these cutting-edge therapies.
Stem cell therapies.
On Google. What were your feelings about that when you watched that?
Well, okay, so she's at a Catholic hospital, which you would never go if you're doing experimental stem cell research. I would think the last thing you sign up for would be a Catholic working hospital. Anyway, that aside, going to a Google search to look for your answers to the stem cell work that you need to do seems that you're behind the eight ball on that one. And I would worry, as a doctor, anytime my doctor goes and looks and does a Google search on some operation that she's about to perform on me, frankly, I'd be scared.
I thought it was interestingly subversive.
Oh.
Scully and Mulder always were not only on the cutting edge of research, but the cutting edge of how you research. And the X-Files was always on the cutting edge of how you research. Mm. When the lone gunmen were doing internet research, hacking into various sites and the deep web, before anyone even knew what this was, mm-hmm. They were inventing new ways to research.
Right.
Mulder with slideshows in his office,
right,
of research that people wouldn't know about.
And PowerPoint presentation.
And now what are we doing? Well, the show that helped really spawn the popularity of researching on the web,
mm-hmm,
kind of pokes fun at how lazy we've become.
Ah, isn't that true?
Everybody just, we'll Google it.
We'll Google.
That's all we'll do. Got to look it up, got to do the answer, we'll Google it.
Right, we don't have to do that research.
And I thought that that was a really kind of funny, sly joke.
Oh, okay.
Actually.
I give it that.
Wow, there was a lot that we hadn't actually got to. So right before that in the film, I'm sorry, when Scully visits the crime scene out in the ice and tells Mulder not to go into the darkness, you can't save your sister. And really what's on her mind is whether she should or can't save that child, her patient, Christian. And Billy Connolly's character, Father Joe,
yep,
comes up behind her, very dreamlike. I mean, all of this, again, this idea that we expressed that the whole movie can be read as if it's Scully's dream.
Yep.
For much of that scene, there's Scully alone watching Joe and Mulder talk to each other. Or right, there's a two-shot from the front, which shows Scully behind them watching. And then the way that Father Joe floats up behind her, like a dream. The whole thing is so dreamlike with the slow snow falling. And he just says to her the words, "Don't give up."
Yeah. And what's fascinating is the criticism on this scene's a lot, I remember, from 2008, was that it was unreal. This seemed impractical. This seemed unbelievable. And yet, now that you put it into a dreamscape, you go, oh, my God, not only does that make sense, that encapsulates it into something much deeper, much more resonant.
If you know that you are watching the work of gifted storytellers, why wouldn't you at least ask yourself, why does it seem unreal?
Right. And this comes to the problem.
Asking the question why.
Yeah.
And indeed, much of the X-Files,
yes,
it should be called, as we've been talking about in the last episode without actually hitting the nail on the head, it should be the XY files. Because this is about the integration of masculine and feminine.
Right.
You shouldn't be watching the X without asking the Y.
Right.
And what is an X? An X is a cross. An X is two paths that intersect.
Mm-hmm.
We are approaching the part in the movie where the two paths that these characters are on are intersecting and seem to be going in opposite directions.
Right. And I recall...
And if you ask yourself why,
mm-hmm,
you might lead to a more interesting discussion than, oh, this is bad.
Right. And this discussion comes from, clearly, I think, the days where we started discussing the budget of movies. Like, we started the intricacies of the backstory. There was a writer's strike. This movie only had this kind of budget.
Are you saying we're responsible for it?
I'm not.
In our coverage of the inner workings of Hollywood?
I'm saying we're now reversing that because so much of Variety, Hollywood Reporter, reported on...
Deadline?
But pre-Deadline. Deadline was the website that grew out of Hollywood Reporter. I agree. Or not. Anyway, the point is that once we started discussing budgets, intricacies, we stepped away from this kind of dream analysis, this kind of writer's intuitive process and what they're trying to express. And by doing that, we have lost so much of what movies are about that, to me, is now resonating much more deeply for a movie, X-Files 2, that I just kind of dismissed so many times in so many podcasts.
A little while later in the film, Scully will say to Mulder that she can't go looking for the monsters anymore. Mm-hmm. But we go from that moment of Father Joe saying, don't give up, to Dr. Frankenstein. We go to the monster, right? The monster. We see the monster being cut together in this experimental procedure. We mm-hmm. see a woman in a box. And
from her point of view,
we see from her point of view what's going on, and we see and the doctor Frankenstein is the wonderful character actor who would appear on many episodes, right?
Many episodes, yeah. Alex Dyken, like a famous.
I loved most specifically. I always recognize him from the episode Humbug.
No, that's right. Great actor. I've seen him in so many plays up in Vancouver. When I was working up there, and such a great, great character actor. It's great to see him on this movie.
And we see the man on the table,
mm-hmm.
and he is crying the tears of blood. So we know that there's a connection already between Father Joe and the man on the table.
Yep.
We know that there's a connection between Scully the doctor and this doctor.
Yes.
We know there's a connection. Their connection... will be revealed, the patient and Father Joe. But the connection between Dr. Frankenstein and Dr. Scully is one that we have to find.
Yes.
Subtextually through what's revealed.
Right. So we have to bring ourselves to this movie.
So after her Google search, mm-hmm. where she learns about, she's late to the hospital. Mm-hmm. A decision's been made on Christian. And she rejects that decision as the primary medical caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
She exerts her authority, and she does her Google research.
Yes.
And, she ignores the call from Mulder. She ignores that call.
Right.
As she does her experimental research. And it's interesting because he's learning many of the same things about a similar process.
Right.
That she is learning in his research.
Isn't that funny?
The left arm doesn't know what the right arm is doing.
Binary.
And, of course, we've just seen a body on a slab being worked on that has a left arm from one being and a right arm from another being.
Tied together.
Mulder, meanwhile, in his investigation, he's disappeared into a women's locker room at the pool, And I love that. And the man who runs the pool says, doesn't he know that's the women's side?
Right.
The women's side. Well, as we've been establishing in this film, Mulder, at his best, is the masculine embodiment of the female side of all of our makeups.
Right.
He does know that's the women's side, and indeed, when he next appears, it will be in a locker room, only lo and behold, it's at the hospital.
With Scully.
And he's confronting Scully after her experimental procedure.
Yes, fantastic.
And talk about this scene, because this was a scene that at the time, to you, to many people, really felt inauthentic.
Yes. And this was the idea that Scully changes gears. Just like, I told you to become part of the FBI. Why are you like the FBI? Like, she channeling, like, it's a 180 in her total motivation of getting Mulder out of the isolation of the cabin, and that now he's pursuing that. She's totally upset that he's pursuing it. And it seemed like this bizarre, well, you're the one who suggested that he get out of this isolation, go back to the FBI, and now he's in the FBI, and he's like, he's going after a case, then suddenly you're all upset about that sort of thing.
She admits that she's afraid, mm. right? She admits that she's afraid.
Right.
She says that she can't go to the darkness. She can't have the darkness. She can't let the darkness be where she lives anymore. She keeps saying home, but it means where she lives. Mm-hmm. And of course, the interesting thing about it is we now see Mulder, who is truly exploring the darkness, but he, with each passing minute in this movie, becomes more light.
Right.
More light. When first saw him in that cabin, there was a dark cloud over him.
Right, he was hunched over.
He was the darkness.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he has now managed to find himself, and he keeps saying, I'm fine, Scully.
I'm good.
And indeed he is. We believe it. Mm-hmm. He is the light in the darkness. The yin-yang symbol of the light in the darkness. The darkness in the light.
Very
good. He is the light in the darkness.
Right.
She is terrified of embracing that darkness in her light. That darkness that she must explore if she is going to fulfill her hero's journey.
Right.
In hopefully saving this patient. But whatever her journey is.
Yeah.
Indeed. So, she gives up on him. She even says... She's giving up. She will not be coming with him. She will not be coming home.
Right.
She's done. She gives up at the halfway point. He goes on and says, okay, well, I have to be true to who I am. I'm going to continue to bring the light to the darkness and explore it. She is seen descending the staircase, descending from that light of
the stained glass of the
Virgin Mary. Descends down, is confronted by the parents of her patient, who tell her no,
we changed our minds.
It's over. And she says, and when she
confronts them,
they say, well, you would understand if you were a mother.
Right.
And she responds to that rather painful comment by saying, have you talked to Father Ibarra, who is her administrative boss at the hospital?
Right, the priest.
And they admit that, yeah, he's the one that frightened us.
Right.
So talking to the father is what frightened them. If, you know, if she was a mother, she would understand.
Right. Ironic.
And... But what's really quite feels, even though, like we're saying, from a point of view of X-Files, of Scully, of Mulder, of what we believe we know about them, of what we want from them, maybe it feels inauthentic. But when we think about it from a depth psychology standpoint, and this is why I said last week and I've said before, if this movie didn't have the name The X-Files on it, I think a lot of people would champion this movie. A lot of people would have enjoyed it. A lot of critics especially would have given it a good review who did not, because that scene where she has to give up on Mulder.
Yeah.
She has to give up so that when she is confronted by these parents, she can realize, no, I'm not going to give up.
Right.
She has to have true crisis of conscience.
Right.
In order to be able to find that strength.
Awesome. And so let's watch more of this. Because we have...
Well, I thought we had.
No, we're now 30 minutes in.
But we have watched more. Well, indeed we have. So that got us to the midpoint.
Oh, my God, we did. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that got us to the midpoint and then to afterwards where she realized that she would keep going.
Mm-hmm.
She even asks the parents. She even more or less echoes what Mulder said to her. You know, what if we make the wrong choice?
Right.
By stopping.
Right.
Right. What if that was the wrong choice? What if we could save him?
Yeah.
Which is what motivates Mulder. There are women out there. What if we could save them?
Right.
We then cut to Manners Colonial Hospital, which is obviously
Kim Manners,
a reference to Kim Manners.
Bless his soul.
Directed so many of the best.
Oh my gosh!
Episodes,
brilliant.
Can you say a couple? I mean, you've talked before about how great he was working as an actor,
right?
But what about some of the atmosphere and the style? That
oh my gosh!
To the show,
you know, if you ever need to learn about mise en scène. Look at anything Kim Manners directed. That guy could tell a story in a single scene, and to see him work, we did an X-Files episode called Unusual Suspects. It was the first gunman episode, and there's a scene where there's aliens, and X comes behind us and prepares to shoot us, and there's the drugs that are going to be sent off. There's so many elements in this one scene that have to be told inside of 3.5 minutes. And at this point, Kim Manners had quit smoking, so he chewed toothpicks. And he had an entire warehouse, actors. He had all these little alien girls. They were like little ballerinas from a dance school in Port Coquitlam that would come. And so he had like maybe 70, 80 people just staring at him while he sat there chewing a toothpick going, how do I do that? And he sat there for like 5 minutes chewing this toothpick. And you could see his thought process going on. And he said, all of a sudden, three cameras. I need one up in a crane here. I need you guys to wrap this over here. And he basically shot the entire story in one shot. In an amazing thing. It took him 5 minutes to think this through on a toothpick. But then he basically covered, and you look at it in Unusual Suspects, it is an overhead shot. They're wrapping up the thing. It is an amazing thing. And to have that kind of brilliance.
Well, it becomes
X-Files set.
Three cameras become so difficult. A lot of times, yeah, to try to speed things up, people will go two cameras.
Right.
Third becomes so difficult because how do you not show the other cameras?
Right. Yeah, like how do you separate that
out? And so I love that the reference to Kim Manners comes in this movie right before we introduce the third path. We've been operating on so many binaries.
Right.
The two different timelines at the beginning of the film that seem to be going on at the same time, but we realize that they're different actual timelines. So we're wondering to ourselves, well, will a third timeline ever be introduced?
Right.
It's about to be introduced.
There you go.
Will, you know, we seem to be on these two different investigative paths. The path,
yes,
to save the child, the path to save the missing FBI agent. Two different sets of experimental medical procedures.
Right.
Are these two things ever going to come together in a third
merge
path? And they do at Manners Memorial or a hospital, Colonial
ironically
Hospital.
Yep.
When we meet the organ transport man,
mm-hmm,
and
the
we
Russian
realize who he works for.
Right.
And then right after we learn that, we go to our third path, which is Father Joe, and we realize, oh, he's the linchpin, he's the third path, he's the doorway for the integration of all these things.
Right.
Indeed, who's outside his door but Scully? Scully comes to him, the voice that said, don't give up.
Right.
She seeks an answer from him. She gets no answer that satisfies her,
right,
though she does get a powerful answer in the form of his seizure. His powerful being
vision,
taken by other forces.
Yes.
At that moment, we hear dogs barking.
Right.
Dogs, of course, always sense a seizure before it happens.
Right.
But it turns out these dogs are in a different location.
Isn't
they're
funny
at that other place where the experimental medical procedure is going on.
Mm-hmm.
But why are they docking? Why are they barking?
Barking?
Because they sense a seizure that's about to happen.
The
patient on the table is about to go into a seizure, and the dogs sense
freak
that
out. Yeah,
they sense that. So, so we're really close to the connection.
That's
here. And indeed, we then learn it when Mulder shows up to see Father Joe being taken away.
Right,
and they reveal that the patient being operated on, the boss of the organ transport, was one of the 37 boys that Father Joe had molested.
Right.
He's now grown. He's now dying of cancer.
Right.
And he's married to the man who has been abducting these women.
Right.
And apparently supervising the procedures being done on him.
So awesome. Okay, let's watch more. We're now into the third act of the X-Files 2 movie, I Want to Believe. We are
more than an hour and 12 minutes in, Dean
right,
Haglund.
31 minutes left remaining in this fascinating.
I'm not going to do a subtextual reading of the end credits.
No.
No, we will, as we said, talk about the
Easter egg. That bugged me so much.
That bugged you so much, yeah.
But let's go from now where we are.
Okay. You want to go from where we are? That's exciting. yes, where we picked up was, obviously Mulder continuing on his investigation after Father Joe had been taken away, whisked away to the hospital with the seizure. It was whisked. It was.
And he has terminal. But
Mulder's investigation with the FBI agents leads them to downtown Vancouver, Hastings Street.
Right.
And
good to see. Still looks great after all these years.
And it's interesting because Exhibit leads the charge on an investigation up into the building to try to track down the organ transplant courier.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, he gets out of the building to find where Mulder and Scully's fill-in,
Amanda Peet,
are having Agent Dakota Whitney are having a conversation similar to the ones that Mulder and Scully
would
used
have
to have
on the show,
as if she needed to have a stand-in for herself.
Right, if this was a dream
in this dream, the courier comes out, and it leads to a chasing on foot. Yeah,
foot.
That continues to be intercut with what Exhibit and the other FBI agents are finding.
Right. So their chasing is as dramatic.
So
where they're revealing what they're finding.
So what the FBI agent who represents something disowned,
right,
in us, in Scully. And the FBI agent that kind of is filling in a little bit for Scully.
Right, or the avatar.
Or is that element that will allow for an integration between Scully?
Fantastic.
Go to, and I find this very interesting because that whole chase sequence feels kind of un-X-Files.
It does, right? Yeah, it feels as if they're trying to make a movie chasing from another movie. Like, it seems like it's directed outside the realm. Like, they farmed out the direction of it. I'm not sure why it feels so foreign.
Well, it really, again, if we're talking about it as a dream, what's fascinating is, like, there's one scene. First of all, it leads into a construction site. Mm-hmm. It's a building under construction.
Right, so the scaffolding, there's plastic.
Almost like an acknowledgement that chase scenes thrown in at the end of Act 2 of movies
yes.
are often, wait for it, or not well constructed.
Look at you.
Not fully constructed.
Right, you
and
just toss that.
Within this construction site, there are walls that seem to be sweating, which is such like an X-Files image.
Right.
But it's a open-air building. Like, why? This almost seems like an image out of the X-Files dropped into, as you said, a chase scene from another movie.
Right.
And meanwhile, what is disowned for us, i.e. Exhibit, is going and really dealing with the blood and the guts
of the thing.
Of the X-Files.
Yes.
Right, this unknown commodity. And meanwhile, our hero is in a not fully constructed chase scene.
Isn't that weird? And chase scenes are actually hard to direct. I mean, you see so many of them, but there's very few directors that can actually
build that together. I think that this is some kind of really subversive commentary.
I hear that.
Because what happens to Dakota Whitney at the end of this chase scene?
Well, she dies.
Right, she dies. But how does she die?
She falls and is impaled on rebar.
As impaled through her heart.
Yes.
By the spikes.
On rebar. Rebar spikes on the construction site.
So to go... Ollie. So to,
Billy, you want to put that...
For the X-Files to go through these kind of chase sequences, these kind of action sequences, result in the X-Files losing their beating heart. To allow that which has become disowned in the show and in ourselves and in Scully.
Oh, my God.
To be alone in the investigation is to lose our head.
Holy shit, are you saying that this movie, it is not just about the characters losing their head, but the show itself disassociated himself from the very heart of what made that show itself.
Well, what do we find? We find someone, Dakota Whitney gets impaled through the heart.
Yeah.
We find the other FBI agent's severed head.
Yeah.
There are three female FBI agents in this film. There's the missing one, mm-hmm. there's Dakota Whitney, and there's Scully, because she is, as we've always known her, an FBI agent.
Even if she's disappointed herself in.
One loses her head, one loses her heart.
Oh my gosh.
This path of integration has to be mind, heart, spirit, and...
And here we come back to a criticism that said, and was the point, that Exhibit and Amanda Peet never had any association to the X-Files. Why are they cast in this movie? And it's about this disassociation from the X-Files itself.
Yeah, that this is, again, further dismemberment.
Dismemberment. The movie is a dismemberment of the TV series itself. It's unbelievable.
And when we've acknowledged this, what happens next? Mm-hmm. Mulder and Scully come together on the landing beneath that stained glass painting.
Right, in the Catholic hospital.
A tender moment that no one could have a problem with.
Right.
Of partners, then, Scully reaching out for his hand and him taking her hand in that moment. Mm-hmm. That is suddenly a moment of connection that Romo's, non-Romo's, no one would have a problem with that.
Truly.
It takes place not on the descent staircase where she went, nor at the top where the light is streaming, but ascent. On that middle ground between, that third path.
True.
And as she stands there consoling Mulder, who has she become? She has become Our Lady of Sorrows. That is the sign behind. It's no longer a cross behind her. It's no longer a question of faith. She has become Our Lady of Sorrows, which is a great description for who Scully was
all the time
in that show.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, that which wounded her is what healed her.
Oh my gosh, it's so true.
They go in and they see Father Joe, who is in
the intensive care bed.
Structurally, narratively, maybe there's some hiccups there where only now does he get to find out his connection to the case. But what I love about it is that he now cries human tears.
True.
Now out of the grips of these perhaps visions from God, perhaps visions caused by his illness,
mm-hmm.
an illness that connected him yet again physically to this boy that he molested who has grown up to become the man being experimented upon. Free of those, he now gets to cry the tears of a human being.
Right.
So his path has been to become human.
Right.
He's been the devil.
Yes.
He's been God.
And now
he gets to become a human being.
Look at that.
On his deathbed.
Fantastic. Do you have any more, or should we watch the last act?
I think I do.
Can we save that?
Well, no.
Okay.
I think we go... For that final part of the conversation really just was riveting to me just now, because they've found the FBI agent's severed head.
Yes.
So they know she's dead.
Yeah.
But Father Joe has maintained that she's alive.
Alive.
And so they use that as proof that he's wrong.
Right.
That they don't need to pay attention to his visions anymore. They don't really know quite what's going on.
Right.
And we do from one reading. But already, just if we were watching this the first time, it begs an interesting question, because they've found her head. But what are we? What
are we just
human
our
beings?
Head?
What do we identify as?
Well, our soul, our heart, all that.
You
sort
keep
of
shouting. You're swallowing the microphone.
Oh, please.
My goodness. What are we? You know, and it's that age-old thing. If you sever your arm, you say, oh, look at my arm.
Right. If you sever your head.
What part do you identify with?
My head.
And they are saying that she's dead because they found her head.
And yet,
he is saying she's alive. And as we find out...
Oh, well, don't blow it. We got to save it for the third act.
Well, one more.
Well, yeah, a scene that you don't want to talk about because it annoys you, and I think the very reason that annoys you is why I would think you would like this scene. Because it acknowledges your point of view.
Right.
So, you know...
What's my point of view?
In the hallway outside, Scully is able to acknowledge that she... You know, she's cautioning Mulder about continuing forward. There's already been this death toll.
Right.
But she says, you know, look, don't get me wrong. I do, you know, about your stubbornness. Your stubbornness is what led me to fall in love with you. And Mulder then says, and that's why we can't be together. And you haven't liked this scene.
Never did.
But... Yes, we can understand linguistically that he means it's my stubbornness that is why we can't be together.
Okay.
But literally what those words mean is because you're in love with me, we can't be together.
What?
That's what he says, and that's why we can't be together.
Because
we're in love? It's your stubbornness that led me to fall in love with you, and he said, and that's why we can't be together. So what he's literally saying, what they are literally subversively saying is, if these characters are in love,
yes,
they can't be together, we need to separate them.
Ah, which... totally supports my thing.
Of course it does.
Oh, look at me go.
Because what is this loving relationship in this movie about? It's about the feminine-masculine integration.
Right.
And if we want to go so far as to say that this is Scully's dream, it's about the integration of the masculine and feminine within her.
Her. Which was a more
which
important,
would
sorry.
Be represented
yep.
in a dream by, oh, I don't know, the, herself and her masculine counterpart, her partner, kissing at the end of the dream, which would represent the integration.
And maybe Russian head transplant. I just blew it. Right, so here we are.
So Mulder, we pick up in Act 3.
Yeah, we watched the entire movie now. We're in
right.
third act.
And after the scene in the hospital... between Mulder and Scully,
right.
about how they can't be together. Mulder continues on his investigation, goes to a place called Nutter's Feed.
With David Nutter, who directed the pilot, who directs many a pilot, brilliant director.
And who therefore gets the homage by having the feed store...
named after him?
Where Mulder goes to investigate, I think, the prescriptions into those animal tranquilizers,
right.
if I'm not mistaken. But, of course, it would be Nutter's Feed... because it's his work in the original pilot, off of which everyone involved is still feeding.
Ah.
Right? I mean, this is why, you know, the
true.
Person who directs a pilot is often considered a co-creator of the show. It's
and,
often,
yes, and in DGA rules, they get a piece of the money of yeah. every episode.
They're an executive producer, yeah, in DGA rules, absolutely, because they have authored... much the same way that the writer of the pilot has created the characters, they've created the look for the show.
Absolutely. And David Nutter is the good luck charm for a series to be picked up and run for a long time. If you look up David Nutter on your IMDb, you will see the number of series that he has directed the pilot episode for that has continued on for many, many episodes and many seasons.
So we've talked a lot about how the number three was going to become critical in this, that
crucial.
Everything was set up in opposition. There was binary. There was two of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And yet from the very beginning, it was this needing for integration.
Right.
The mind-body-spirit integration. There needs to be the third.
Right.
In that very opening, they set up that wonderful back-and-forth juxtaposition between what seems like... it's going on concurrently, but is actually two different timelines. And so we ask ourselves, might there be a third timeline?
Might there be?
Well, indeed there was.
Right.
That third timeline was the storyline of the priest with those children. Because that timeline is what set all these other two offshoot timelines in motion.
Right.
Almost in quantum mechanics, how one decision, one pivot, leads to two different universes being created.
Very good.
And three, the symbol of three occurs again after Nutter's Feed, when Mulder is following Callum Keith Rennie in his truck, and the truck is being chased by three dogs.
Three dogs. Right. No explanation where they come from. They just run out into the road. They're barking at
dogs, which represent so many things. I mean, our animal instincts,
right.
of course.
They're three-headed dog of Cerberus, the gates of hell.
but also, what are dogs? Dogs are loyalty,
mm-hmm.
and our instincts. And so, being chased by the three of these, the integration of these things,
and then Mulder drives off.
Well, he follows.
Yeah,
and back at the hospital,
we cut intercut. Right?
Scully goes to her office, mm-hmm. and she finds that the printer has stalled while printing out all that stem cell research she was doing. So we find out that much like our two different timelines, can find their integration in the third timeline, which is actually in the past. Mm-hmm. Of the priest with those boys, so too do we find that those two separate medical experiments, her stem cell experiments with the boy,
the
Dr. Frankenstein's experiments with these abducted people, and the victim dying of cancer, that they are in fact linked, and they all link to those experiments going on in Russia. But right before. And it really becomes a different movie. From the point she walks in to that office, from then through the end, it becomes a different movie.
And almost like a different director, frankly.
Almost like a different director, which is fascinating for you to say, because who is sitting outside her office right before that scene?
Right.
But the director.
Chris Carter,
who's holding an urn.
Oddly enough, I don't
know. An urn, which is such an interesting symbol. So he's holding the ashes of what? Something's died and been cremated, been burned to create these ashes. I watched that third act when it first came out, rooting for this movie.
Uh-huh.
Knowing that this movie did not get the budget that it deserved.
Yeah.
Knowing that it, if you'll pardon the expression, did not get the budget they had earned.
Earned.
And knowing that when you see this third act, they could not conclude this movie that they had set up in a truly satisfactory way.
It's true. They had set something up so huge.
Potentially, yeah.
That they could not actually just.
It ends up becoming too small in how they wrap it up. You even allude to how the geography starts to be almost nonsensical in some ways.
In the Russian operating room.
Well, but even before that, like I would say, you know, you can believe that he's followed the path that the truck has taken, but you know, it's like he's walking around with a concussion, Mulder, after being driven off the road.
Yeah.
And how long did it take him? It doesn't seem to have taken him very long.
He suddenly showed up.
None of it makes sense in a quote-unquote realistic sense. It
geography.
It does make sense in terms of this dream logic that we're talking about, the way that dreams compress time.
If this is
space.
Scully's dream,
mean even in our dream. In our dream, mythologically and metaphorically, this is fine, but they can't quite create the realistic world anymore that the X-Files would always give you. And I feel like there are some winking hints in here, and maybe even some rather barbed satire on the part of the satire. You know, because when the material's printed out, what are some of the things we see? Well, we see a dog with a severed head that gets another head put on it. Again, as I always like to say, if this is not an acknowledgement on Chris Carter's part that this dog won't hunt.
Yeah.
you know, I don't know what else they're saying. And and for him to introduce himself there, for him to then have that symbol, for us then to see what transpires in this third act and to say, you know, we weren't given a fair shake to pull this off. And that compound.
I got my head to that.
Where Mulder comes to, it's guarded by a two-headed dog.
Right.
Right. So if we talk about like dogs embody loyalty, if you're of two heads, you're of two minds. So you're loyal to what? This is a movie that really, from a commercial and business standpoint, seems to be of two different minds by this point.
Absolutely. You are stuck between
the story you want to tell and the story that the powers that be either want you to tell
you
or
tell.
Forcing you to tell.
Exactly.
Or and preventing you from telling.
Right. That you have to do the X-Files continuation. We want Black Oil. We want alien abductions. even though that's not intrinsic to the story you want to tell.
Well, and we're not going to give you the money that you need to do this.
Think of that budget was maybe $17 million.
Right. They were spending half of that a decade earlier on a 42-minute episode.
Oh, yes. Half of that. And that went to the trailers that we were all in, for crying out loud.
And so, flash forward all those years, that's not going to cover it.
No.
That's not even going to cover it to give you the...
special effects.
To give you the what you got on television.
Yeah.
Spread out over a running time of more than 100 minutes.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think that there is a lot of, subtextually, I think that there is a lot of subversive commentary on the part of Chris Carter.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of different places we could go, but we're running short on time. We could do a whole third episode if we wanted to. But let's talk about the conclusion here between Mulder and Scully.
Yeah.
When Scully revisits their home, we won't get into this too much, but we were talking about how you learn during the movie that they live together.
Yes.
They talk about going home. And yet when she first comes to that house at the beginning, it's very clear she does not live there.
It seems foreign to her. She's looking around. She has no idea what the space is.
So that becomes really, those are one of those things where before one dismisses it as an error or weakness, ask yourself, why is that so?
Right.
And we've been doing a pretty good job of that, I think, with various things in this movie. Their conversation at the end is great because they've both come at the beginning. They both really admit that where they were at the beginning was... I think at the beginning, he no longer probably wanted to believe. He probably didn't want to believe anymore. He's always wanted to believe.
Right.
I think his arc has been he got to the point where he did want to believe.
And then
at the end, he knows.
He knows.
For her, it was a big step to get to the point that she wanted to believe.
Yes.
And then, as we know, she makes that what seemed to be an odd turn, where she rejects everything.
Right.
But what we know about psychology, of course, is that fear indicates desire. So for someone like her, who is a woman of science, she would react to her desire to believe with fear. She would seek to reject that need in herself.
Absolutely.
And she rejects it in the person of Mulder. By the end, she comes to acknowledge that she knows not only that you can't escape the darkness, but that the darkness comes looking for you, and that
the
answer is to be the light in the darkness.
Ah, which is our show.
They embrace, they kiss. For a no Romo, that's murder.
Ugh.
Although, as we talked about, there's some odd editing in that thing where we suddenly are jumping like mirror shots again.
I know.
Almost like, again, we're going through the looking glass here. Maybe this scene is not meant to be taken literally. And wouldn't it be amazing if when this reboots, this picks up where this has not taken place?
Right.
Because I tell you, I watched that ending just now.
Uh-huh.
And she goes to the hospital, and the morning she arrives at the hospital, it's as if we're at the beginning of the film.
Right.
She sees the priest.
Yeah.
She sees the parents of the child. There is a huge sign that says third next to them. We've found the third path. We've found the integration of everything we've been looking for, the masculine, the feminine, with the intuition, science, rationality, faith. We've mind, body, spirit. We've integrated it all. She is ready to get started. She walks in to the operating room
lab,
and they ask her, are you ready to begin?
Right.
Dr. Scully, are you ready to begin?
She looks around.
She looks around.
There's three nuns at the window.
There are now three nuns at the window.
Right.
And she says, yes. And cue the X-Files theme.
Right.
The story begins right then.
Isn't that something?
And so the story of Dana Scully has been rebooted.
Right.
We found out who she is, where she is,
and what she came from.
And it's a very, again and again, we could go on and on about the threes, the three abductees the first FBI agent, the girl swimming, Mulder becoming abducted at the end. There's so much. I'll throw one last symbol out that I think is lovely closure in this film. The mystery begins, if we can say, with the discovery of the severed arm.
Yes.
And it is the left arm
of
a man that has been wounded and scarred. It ends... it ends with Scully alone.
Right.
But before that, she's pulled into this mystery through the discovery of a wounded left arm of a man.
Right.
She finds closure and healing in the arms of a man whose right arm is bandaged and wounded.
Ah, look at that. I love that.
Do you want to bring up the post credit sequence before we go?
Okay, so after the credits, Mulder and Scully are rowing in bikinis to a deserted island.
In the ocean. We've seen in that final scene where Mulder and Scully embrace and kiss. That the snow is melting.
Right.
The feminine has become unfrozen.
So when I saw this,
the intuition, the feminine attributes have become integrated, have become embraced.
I saw this as a disassociation from the whole movie, that it was like a complete annihilation of the search for the truth, that Mulder and Scully just bugger off to a deserted island, blank boodly-doo, to hell with all of ya, whatever you thought the movie or the TV series was about, go to hell, Mulder and Scully are going to live their life out on a deserted island. And it's like, oh my god, what? And I was so pissed off at that Easter egg. Now, the way we discussed this movie and the way it was like interpreted as a Scully's dream sequence, it makes much more sense. If Scully had a dream,
I don't know if it makes sense, but I'm fascinated by it because it any way you slice it, it stands out as so odd. It's really odd.
Yes.
Because even if they wanted to end it that way, to end it with such the phony CGI aspect, everything about it is so odd that it just makes you think, why? I feel like I'm not getting something, that there, at the very least, is a really sly inside joke.
Inside joke with the crew. Like, it seems almost like a crew joke, almost, like that... that everybody gathered around, like there was a birthday party where something happened. I don't know.
And there's one cautionary thing that I would end on. This is going back a little bit in the film, but I thought it was a really, again, a nifty little satirical jab at maybe the culture, at maybe the audience. And as we go towards the X-Files reboot coming to air, I think that this is an interesting thing. When Mulder is chasing Callum Keith Rennie, when he's following him, he's in that truck. He pulls out his cell phone from a decade earlier to try to call Scully.
Right.
And he's scrolling through his contacts.
Right.
And the contacts are Bowman.
Rob Bowman,
who directed the first big screen movie.
And the pilot of The Gunman.
Vince Gilligan. Gilligan.
Breaking Bad.
Of course, one of the co-executive producers, writers of X-Files.
And
creator
Lone Gunman.
Breaking Bad. Lone Gunman.
Better Call
then
Saul.
Then there's Scully.
Yeah.
And then Scheiben.
John Scheiben, who was like one of the four writers, worked on Breaking Bad as well, and many other series.
And what I love about it is while he's scrolling through this list of names that led to the greatness that was The X-Files, he gets into an accident and almost dies. And so the message being, if you let yourself get distracted by what has come before, that is a pitfall, that is perilous terrain from which you may not recover. So there's I believe, is Chris Carter's warnings to the fan base.
So with that, let us remember that this is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Don't get distracted by what's come before.
Always
over these last 2 weeks.
Go forward in our episodes.
We will be back with another installment that will have nothing to do with the X-Files.
That's right. Till then, I'm Dean Haglund.
I'm Phil Larinus.
See you soon.
You almost said that you love them.
I do love them.
But you won't have a relationship with them. You are a no-romo with our listeners.
That's right. It's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Belated spoiler alert.